Meeting the small people coming, but we should start. Thank you for joining us today. This is our last Tuesday seminar of the term, and possibly the last Tuesday seminar of the year, because next year we're going to be moving our Easter seminars to Wednesdays earlier in the time. So free your calendar at 2:30 to 4 o'clock on Wednesdays for after the New Year's. And it's not our last event. We're finishing our events with a web online event next Monday, talking about regional financial centers published for Greece and Cyprus, with a very impressive lineup of speakers. If you're interested on financial centers in the wider Balkan region, please visit our website to sign up for the online event. But today we have the pleasure to have with us Philippos Petroulakis, to talk to us about, well, broadly speaking, industrial policy, or what to do with industrial policy in Greece, focusing on, as you can see also in the title, skill mismatch, management issues, and innovation. In the country, this is related to a project that has been funded by the Hellenic Observatory with external research goals. The project was called an Intelligent Industrial Policy for Sustainable Growth. Our speaker today is to present the work done by the research team is Philippos Petroulakis, who is a research economist at the Economic Analysis and Research Department of the Bank of Greece. He has previously worked as an economist at the European Central Bank and previously also at the IMF and at Nomura. His expertise, as we're talking also, Philippe, is quite broad, looking at labor market issues, issue of productivity, international economics, monetary policy, among others, I should say. He has a PhD from economics in economics from the University of Maryland, but he's also an LSE alumnus. He did his master's in economics here at the London School of Economics recently, as we were saying also. And he's done a lot of work on Greece. I was also looking at some more kind of recent work on COVID and the labor market, but also has a few quite impressive international publications, including in the International Labor International Labor Relations Economica. Industrial labor relations review, that's why it couldn't come out, but also a lot of significant work on the issue of the Greek economy, and including on how to go forward with innovation and labor market mismatches. So he's going to talk to us about the work they've done on the project now. You can take questions as we go along, but we'll have the Q&A after the presentation.
So thank you very much, Vasily, for the kind words and for the invitation. First of all, I should say that you should feel free to interrupt me as much as you can. So this is a joint work with the project, joint work with Sophia, who's also from the bank, Yannis Kalogiru from NTUA, Katerina Karnadimitropoulou from UNDP, and Kostas Delis from a web, who I believe was here. Some of you may know that he was a fellow there. So, the starting point for this project, the motivation, is first of all, the goal that you guys had, but you know, more broadly, how Greece is developing its economy after the massive hit we took 15 years or so ago. So when I left the LSE in 2009, things were just about to start, but no one knew. But you know, we entered the global financial crisis with bloated fiscal and external sector dependence. And you know, painful cuts and mass internal adjustment, imports plummeted. Things improved very, very slowly. Greece showed pretty big resilience to COVID, and now it's been growing way above the average. But the problem is that the fundamental structure of the Greek economy has not really shifted. We seem to be stuck in a low wage, low productivity equilibrium, and you know, the bulk of new jobs are generated from low productivity activities. There's there's some pockets of excellence. Pharma is a particular one that's been going quite well over the past few years, to some extent a result of policy as well. Shipping, also some interesting niches in robotics, which I was not aware of until recently. Same for local hub of multinationals, and I will show some data on this. Part of this lack of transformation fundamentals, part policy, because we still subsidize tourism, subsidize shipping, industrial policies, you know, we do say that, oh, we want to shift the structural paradigm of the country, but you know, there's no real concrete anything yet. So the focus of this paper is on fundamentals. So in particular, we zero in on three key problem areas of Greek industry. These are the skills and distribution, management practices, and the adoption of technology and innovation. So probably not, we're not going to show you too many new things. But what we instead try to do is tackle well-known problems like these and go really, really granular. And to do so, we assembled a wide array of data sets. You should probably be familiar with all of them. The novelty in our data comes from this survey by Lai, and that's a laboratory of industrial engineering, but it's a lab at NTUA, it has a very novel data set on technology adoption in particular. And we're also going to provide some policy suggestions. So I should say that my publisher made me show this to you. This is coming up as a book soon by Economia Publishing, which is the, you should know, it's the most prominent Greek publishing house on this issue. And we just got the cover and we really like it. So okay, so first we're going to look at labor market skills in Greece. So typically we start by looking at skills by looking at educational attainment. And in that regard, we're actually not too bad. So in 2020, over 44% of young adults had completed tertiary education, which is higher than the EU average and also quite a bit higher than Greece in 2010. So, should be good. At the same time, we still have persistent lingering concerns about the alignment of skills needed for the labor markets and what our educational system produces. We also score very badly in a host of surveys of skills, be adult, like SCLP or PISA, as we were discussing before, which also imply pretty big shortage of skilled labor. And of course, this imply big, significant barriers to growth. But this is about the stock of skills. Instead, we're going to look about the distribution of skills. And in particular, we're going to look at all the job mismatch, which is the misalignment of skills and qualifications with job requirements. And that happens because workers vary a lot in the skills that they can perform a different task, leading to a difference compared to advantage of, in a Ricardian sense, basically, of people across tasks. And efficiently matching workers to suitable jobs is key for productivity growth. Like, for example, if a firm hires an overskilled worker, it might be probably beneficial for the firm, but there's a big externality for the aggregate sector because it deprives the aggregate economy of those skills. And it can also impact within firm growth because you know, reallocating resources to more productive firms allows them to grow. And this is a key factor explaining the difference in aggregate productivity growth across countries. The difference in worker reallocation from low to high productivity firms. And of course, this becomes a lot more important when the overall supply of skills is limited, as is the case. So the literature tends to focus on separating over and under skilling. And it's kind of a stylized fact by now that overskilling is a more important deal for productivity than underskilling. What we do instead was dig a bit deeper and examine how mismatch differs across occupations. And we distinguish between what we call professional occupations. So basically, if you're familiar with the ISCO classification, ISCO 1 and 2 are professional, and the rest is bucketed into one group. And we use OECD's PIAC, forget what it stands for. It's every college survey of adult skills. It's harmonized, consensus, is a standard reference for these studies. And basically, they ask workers. So the survey asks workers whether they feel they have the skills to cope with more demanding duties than those required to perform the current job, and whether they feel they need further training in order to cope well with the present duties. And this is used to define overskilling mismatch. And the workers are assigned overskill or not, whether if the proficiency score in literacy test, which is included in the survey, is higher than that corresponding to the 95th percentile of self-reported well-matched work. And well-matched workers are those who report that they neither have the skills to do anything more demanding or that they need further training to do their job well. So we just follow the literature here and use literacy proficiency as the standard metric. We also, as a cross, use numerical proficiency, which is also included in nothing really changes. Okay, so results are shown here. To the left, we have overskill mismatch, to the right, underskill. So the red bars show professional jobs, high skill jobs, and the blue bars are all the rest. So you see that Greece sticks out like a sore thumb. It's an extreme outlier for overskill mismatch. And this is even more surprising because typically overskill mismatch is lower for professional occupations.
To which year?
Right. So this is 2014 for Greece.
2014. In the middle of the crisis.
It is. I mean, with most of our data like this, they tend to have, like, it's a one shot, maybe every 10, 15 years. This is an issue for sure. Like, we're definitely capturing a very turbulent part of the Greek cycle. But I should say that it's about half the countries were 08, 09, the other half 14. So it's not like anyone was in a stellar position when they took. But this is definitely a concern that nothing we can do about it. Because Greece is such an outlier, we really do be careful to make sure this is not driven by the fluke. So you get similar results for numeracy, also adjusting the cutoff points, like 90, 10, 8. If we go 80, 20, you start to lose power, but the story is the same. We also control for sector of fixed effects. And we also had a look at a different survey, European Worker EWCS, I forget what it stands for. It's produced by CEDEFOP. It's also used to study mismatch and broadly the same picture emerges.
Working standards by Eurofounds, no?
I don't remember. EWCS, European Worker
Conditions
Survey. So, I mean, this is such a surprising finding that, you know, we really wanted to make sure it's not a data flow. For underskilling, it's less of an issue. There's no clear pattern emerging. So it's really overskilling for professional occupations that's a really big increase. It's not like overskilling for low-skill occupations is low. It's just that it's, you know, on the 75th percentile and not in, you know, the highest by far. Okay. So the question there is whether overskill mismatch is more of a problem in professional occupations. Unfortunately, the answer to this is probably, and not a definitive yes, because the data is just not good enough to give us a better response. But I do think the answer should be yes, and I think there's good reasons for this. Like, for one, professional jobs, because they're knowledge intensive, combine high levels of other job learning, other complementarities relevant to these jobs, should have high, match specific human capital. So that means that marginal productivity can vary widely across firms. Then, if the supply of professional skills is low relative to others, then search and matching costs for finding a replacement of those workers should be higher than for other positions. Skill shortages are also likely more binding. And last but not least, this is a relative new area of research in the literature, how discrimination affects talent allocation. This is a very important paper in the literature by Sierre, Chad Jones, and the co-authors in 2019. They showed that removing barriers for disadvantaged groups, particularly women minorities in the US, can account for anywhere between 20 to 40% of total per capita growth in the US over the past four decades, just through improved talent allocation. So it's a truly massive effect. Yeah?
So if you go back one slide, so you're basing this data on this self-reported survey,
mm-hmm.
whether I feel I'm overqualified, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is a cultural tendency in Greece for people to say I'm too qualified to do this job. So can you do a cross-check with other countries? So for example, what you could do is you can take the average skills required in an occupation, sorry, the average education level in an occupation, right? And compare it to the individual's education. And you can do this standardized by other countries. So there are some occupations that we know across, for example, the European Union, the skills requirements are pretty much standardized, right? So what I'm getting, the bottom of this is, are Greeks complaining because, oh, you know, I should be in a better job? Or so I'm very skeptical when Greeks reply to this type of question. And there are ways, I suppose, to, you know, get a more objective measure of whether their skill levels are equivalent to the requirements for this occupation, or whether they are exaggerating that they should be doing something more.
Absolutely.
I'm really a brain search.
But the good thing is that these are benchmarked within country. So this is distribution within Greece. The problem, you have a different problem there, then you get to cells that are tiny.
Okay.
You can have, for X occupation, very few people match badly or not. So to get around this, we instead use cutoffs from Spain and Italy. Where the cells are bigger, these cars have roughly similar skill distribution, so I think it gets around to it. And also, EWCS would do the same thing and get the same results. So I think I fully share the point, but you know, it's a built-in measure to take this into account. Like this is not ours. It's just like standard OECD skills director people who that's the main job. So they're really good at this, and they came up with this criteria. But it's a good point for sure. Thank you. Okay. All right. So, like I said, we feel pretty strongly that this is the case, that indeed overskilled mismatch in high skilled jobs is a big deal. They're just not good enough to show this because basically you need to have enough people who are overskilled, like badly matched. And this is a survey of 2,000 Greeks overall, so we're getting like a few hundred observations. So, you know, I think that since we went for breadth over depth in the study, like if we really had drilled on this, maybe we would have been able to show something, or if we were better experts in this literature. And perhaps with more assumptions, we could have done something.
Perhaps this conclusion could be further backed up by the very high percentage of brain drain, especially during this period.
Yes.
Which has been expanded between, when was it, 11 and 18, if I'm not wrong. 14, 15 was at its peak.
But wouldn't it have been lower with the brain drainers? Because if you had the brain drainers there and you had like an engineer working, selling donuts, that would have been even worse, right?
But it had been climaxing. So 14, 15, 16, 17, it peaked around just before Brexit. No, just after Brexit.
I mean, so, like I said, 2014 is a really bad year to do the survey for Greece. Absolutely. I don't know. Hopefully, there's going to be another wave and we can see some improvement there. I think, like, the next section, we're going to do management skills, also 2014. Like, these are extremely expensive to run. I run a similarly sized survey now. This is too expensive to run. Really, I mean, if you can, guys can get the funding and do it.
But the EWCS goes more recent, no? The latest one is 2020. No?
I should know this, I don't remember. Because that was our focus, EWCS was a cross check. No, it's 2015. So, yeah, it's not. Maybe there's a newer vintage.
Without
I want to check this.
Okay, since we're asking, can I ask also my question about bumping down? I have to warn you, very old case. So one of the things could be that you know, in a labor market where there's basically, you know, demand is collapsing, people are not matched to the best job, but there's bidding for the so the most qualified person gets the first job, and everybody bumps down. So you know the PhD person does the medium skill job, and the person with the master's does the low skill job, and the person with the first degree does the street cleaning kind of job. So that would be also consistent with what you know. Why the professional occupations, the high skill jobs, have more of the skilling than the lower ones? No.
Although I wonder what the implication of this would be for low skill jobs. We're pretty high there too.
Yeah.
No. Could be. But again, it doesn't really negate the fact that you this really big mismatch is a clear why. Like, probably we're not going to be able to get into the why with just looking at the data. You need some other correlates. And the data is extremely rich and free. So if anyone has any ideas, this is just open to everyone. It's kind of a mess to work with because it's just so big. It's very good. Like you could definitely do quite a bit of if you have any idea. Any other question? Yeah, so like I said, it's the data is not good enough to answer this specific question that we're looking for, so I'm just going to skip this. But we, I mean, we confirm what's long-standing literature that overskill mismatch is definitely a big deal for productivity. Like what we do is we get productivity data for more bits. We create sectoral productivity indicators. We match it with PIAC, and basically we have a baseline result which holds quite well here. This is very significant, and this is like a one standard deviation increase in overskill mismatch implies 10% lower level productivity. Controlling for a set of extra vaccinations.
The assumption here is OECD or Greece?
17 European countries.
Yeah,
forget what, but the main OECD in European at the sector level. Okay. But so the upshot here is that we're not able to show that overskill mismatch is a bigger deal for professional occupations, a bigger deal than for non-professional occupations. But overall, it is a big deal. And the point is that because Greece is such an outlier in overskill mismatch for professional occupations, if that's the case, then it's pretty done. Okay. So now we move to the second part of the project. We'll look at the importance of management. Role of management practices, which kind of a management is kind of a latecomer in the productivity growth literature. So like 15, 20 years or so, centered around the World Management Survey, WMS, pretty much created here, I think, like Marina, Bloom, Sadou Limos, and also Christos Giannakos, Greek early contributor to this literature. Very rich production coming from WMS. Has shown that management is positively associated with productivity and a bunch of other stuff like better work-life balance, facilities for workers. And the most, you know, telling about how important management is comes from this paper here, where the WMS team matched with the US Census to include questions, a random sample of US manufacturing firms. And basically they show that differences in manufacturing practices, even within firms across establishments, are so vast that variation in management practices account for as big a difference productivity as ICT, human capital, and R&D, which is the gold standard of things we think when we think what's driving productivity. So WMS, to our knowledge, only Christos Giannakos in 2018 has applied. So WMS, we only look at the manufacturing module, there's a couple of more. As 18 questions started as across countries, they basically train the interviewers in a way to make it really nice and comparable. It's 18 questions split into four categories. These are mono-manufacturing techniques, target setting, monitoring, and people management. And basically we average this over all the firms in the sample, and here we plot the distribution for each country. I should say that there's a couple of different data sets with WMS data that don't really cover all the questions. So I'm going to use two or three different ones of what I'm going to show you. There are some tiny differences, but overall the basic picture is the same. So we see here that this is distribution per country. The red diamond is the mean, the blue bar the intercultural range, and the black bars 50 to 95%. So two things stand out here. First, how low the Greek average is. And these are not only advanced economies. So Greece is on average below India, Brazil, China, Argentina. At the same time, dispersion in Greece is so high, like for example, the 75th percentile is as good as New Zealand, almost as good as Australia, so not too bad. And the elite of Greek firms is actually pretty competitive internationally. So the 95th percentile in Greece is higher than the 95th percentile in Germany. So this is interesting and surprising. And so this low average and high dispersion implies little to no diffusion of best practices from leaders to laggards. And it's there's a really big literature in productivity looking at this, and there's a clear parallel. Like dispersion management practice with dispersion of productivity, because this dispersion of productivity, like the literature attributes it to a lack of low resource allocation and low technological diffusion from leaders to laggards. And if we think that management is a technology, and the WMS people definitely do, there's a clear parallel there. And it's problematic because, as I also mentioned before, differences in resource reallocation have been singled out as a really key driver of differences in productivity across countries. And Greece indeed has one of the largest spatial in productivity in Europe. So here we do the following. We split the WMS data to the left in two groups. With blue are domestic firms, and with red are the subsidiaries of foreign multinationals. So two important issues here. First, Greece has the highest difference between domestic firms and branch of multinationals operating in the country. And the branch of multinationals operating in Greece are very good compared to other countries. So multinationals in Greece do better than multinationals in Sweden and Germany. We didn't really expect that. Christos Yannakos also wrote about this in his paper, and he found it surprising and encouraging. Because on the one hand, like, it's really curious to see how some firms can do so well. This is 2014. And also, the first wave, the smaller, was 2006, the second 2014. So again, it's a real issue with this data that they just come out in these times, but it is what it is. But, you know, his point was that it's both surprising that you can have firms operating so well in a country with such bad macro environment, with, you know, troubling regulatory environment. And it's encouraging because, you know, there's not something wrong in the water. Things can get better. To the right, we do a similar thing where we only look at domestic firms, split them between domestic firms without overseas operations in blue and with overseas operations in red. So the gap here is not the largest in the sample. India is the largest, but it's the largest in advanced economies.
Is there an issue here about the Greek firms possibly being predominantly small and the companies with overseas foreign multinationals potentially being bigger?
Sure.
So the Greek firms may be Kostas and his friend.
Absolutely.
And the multinational companies are much, much bigger.
This is definitely a driver. But this is just manufacturing. So there is a lower bound relative to like the average Greek firm.
Okay.
Like the median Greek firm, like 3-4 people, this is definitely higher because this is just manufacturing. But the multinationals should not differ too much across countries. So this is like, I don't know, Microsoft Greece. With the corporation here is Microsoft Sweden. The size should be somewhat similar.
But they have a paper at the QG where they show that multinationals adjust to the culture of the country where they work. Bloom and Van Rijn and
this one? Because there's so many people in QJ.
It's one on the culture, where they look on trust and the more cultural, and they show that they adjust.
But at the same time, the same guys say that the US multinationals do it better, using data from the UK. Like US multinationals in the UK do better than UK firms. Okay, I'll...
And this is again 2014, right?
And 2006. And 06. And we don't know it.
Because there's a good chance, you know, that many multinationals would have withdrawn from Greece by that time, and only the good ones and, you know, the more productive ones remained, which is why you would see that.
It's a good one.
Can I also say that, I mean, you know, if you also go to the previous one, you can say there's differences in the spread and in the... You know, there's no statistical difference in the mean. So definitely here, and by implication also in the two slides later, you know, in the things that you saw, so the difference are there.
So but these are statistically different.
Not between them, yes, obviously, yes. But like, you know, if you go two slides forward, the US score for domestic firms of 3.354, whatever. The blue bar, and the blue bar for Greece 2.5, you know, looks huge, but it may not be statistically different, especially because the sample in Greece is quite small.
So these are about 550 in Greece, so it's not horrible. Like this type of difference definitely is statistically.
Yeah, well, because on the mean, they're not.
No, for sure, mean is definitely not. But like, depends upon what your benchmark is. So like from 2006 to 2014 in India, like Greece, I'm sure I've been doing better. Maybe not now.
Okay, I mean, I'm comparing US with Greece. No, not my. The 2.7 of Greece mean
yeah,
and the 3.2 of the US is definitely not statistically
different.
And I guess also you take 18 questions and you do one scale from 1 to 5. So
not necessarily.
On other things,
no,
the
sure.
Others.
Kind of lost my train of thought there, but anyway, so. Compare Greek firms with and without overseas operations. It's the largest difference across advanced economies. And it's kind of unclear how to think about this, because on the one hand, we know that the more productive firms are the ones that can have overseas operation, either exporting or having a full-on activity abroad. And so we would expect the countries with higher productivity dispersions to have this hard expression there. At the same time, if you know, if you operate in another country, you with better management practices, you may be exposed to them, and you know, kind of cross-pollinate your local operations with better practices. And you know, there is quite a bit of evidence showing that knowledge-intensive activities like management, you know, are amenable to such spillovers. But you know, kind of reinforces the previous one. It's you know, it's not a good sign, but at the same time, it is encouraging that we can improve. Okay, so now we do something slightly different. We take those 18 questions and we check which are the ones where we do worst relative to average and where we do best. And this is just looking at advanced economy, averages, standard best. So looking at the best, these are introduction of modern manufacturing techniques, retaining talent, rationale for introducing modern techniques, and creating a distinctive employee value proposition. This is like being able to market yourself well to prospective employees. So these are basically close to advanced economy average. The worst performers is pretty bad relative to the rest. This is performance tracking, developing talent, clarity of goals and measurement, and documenting and continuously improving your processes. So if you just gaze a bit here, we seem to be doing, so all the worst performers are broadly related to target setting and monitoring and also talent management. And these are intimately related because basically you have managers unable to set realistic goals and also employee measures to gauge performance. And at the same time, there's a resulting inability to reward and develop talent. By contrast, we are okay in adoption of modern manufacturing techniques and talent retention and attraction. And we think there's an interesting pattern there. We do worst, Greek firms do worst, in issues having to do with teamwork, people management, planning, anything but synergies, dialogue, collaboration. Instead, they do best in things that require decision making, possibly by a single individual, the family. And we thought this was interesting, and we, shopping it around to people. They mostly found it reasonable, and two people told me with like knowledge of Greek industry that yeah, this makes a lot of sense, which is why we're good in shipping, because shipping doesn't require much people management. This industry definitely requires really good decision making. I have no idea how shipping is run, but you know, I think it's reasonable. Anyway, so one corollary of this is that this low employee autonomy, because you know, you basically boss around people and not engaging in the dialogue or collaboration. So we want to test this, and we use PIAC because it's a better sample than the previous survey. And there's a set of questions asking workers to say how free they are in changing the mode, sequence, and speed of tasks, and the work, flexibility in the working hours. And this gives us like a task discretion indicator. And we show this here. So these are basically regress this index on country dummies, because we also want to control for firm size and sector occupation dummies. And this is relative to the top performer, which is Finland. And Greece is way down, the worst performer. So this is a Likert scale from 1 to 5. So almost 1 is a really big difference. It wasn't surprising for me to see this. I think kind of confirms my prior. So basically, like, it's the lowest in OECD in employee autonomy. So we have the Greek firms prevent employees from exercising judgment and require themselves to just follow Greek rules by management. And why is that a problem? It's a problem because this inhibits firm growth. Because almost by definition, your firm cannot grow too much if you basically need to follow whatever the CEO says at all times. You need to empower local management to make decisions, to give them flexibility to respond both to local shocks and just to standard day-to-day routine operations. So there is literature showing that it's like Yon et al. With the WMS team. They found that decentralized firms are more resilient in turbulent markets, markets that were hit more by shocks during the global financial crisis. And there's always a trade-off between the value of local knowledge versus the ability of the CEO to issue centralized decisions. It's always there, but there's some cases where having this flexibility is beneficial for the firm. So this lack of delegation, I think, will point to low trust. And this very common thing that I'm sure we've all heard of it, but I've been nice to otherwise they're going to steal from you. So, because trust facilitates delegation of authority, and there's a couple of channels through which this can raise productivity growth. Like, I don't know if that's the paper you're referring to, Ilya, because I think these guys have two QJs same year with the same data. Basically, like, countries with high trust can allow decentralization of firms, which may be able to raise productivity by, you know, adapting like IT solutions to local problems. And overall, low trust between firms and workers can result in low attachment, low human capital accumulation, and eventually low productivity and wage growth. And at the same time, this lack of delegation also implies limited talent development, which becomes a problem for Greek SMEs when succession becomes an issue. Basically, when the founder, the culture of the firm is centered around the founder retires, this may be problems when they succeed.
But you were saying earlier that there is some heterogeneity in the management styles. You gave the example of shipping. So I'm not completely convinced that trust, because if trust is it's a cultural thing, that should apply across the industrial sectors.
Mm-hmm.
So how convinced are you, given that you're seeing there is heterogeneity?
This is only manufacturing.
Okay.
For sure. It would be really cool to have shipping there. I would suspect that shipping is an industry where, you know, trust people much as not as important. Shipping, you need to know how to run a ship. But most money is made by being able to adapt quickly to market conditions, like lease, charter your fleet at the best conditions and the like, selling and buying ships at the opportune moments. I would guess.
So you referred to trust and firm size. Are you controlling for firm size in the Greek case?
Controlling, it's a general point. Like, Greek firms are small. See, one of the reasons why they're small is lack of trust. Because if you don't delegate your local management, there's only so much you can grow.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a general point about what, like, we know Greek firms are small.
Trust is the cause of Greece having small firms.
Not the opposite. Lack of trust prevents firms from growing. It's a standard result of the literature.
Okay, well, I assume there's also certain other factors which.
Absolutely.
Sorry.
I take Van Rijn and it's kind of very close to the God status, so we cannot question a lot. But that said, I mean, these things are, you know, as said, laid out for the US context. And you know, there's a question of how transferable they are in Greece. So, you know, it partly depends where you are in the technology frontier, for example, and how, you know, the degree of complexity of what you do in the same sector. So just very recently, I met somebody who they're doing the plastic pipes where electric cables go, the plastic in Greece, so, and they're exporting. And I said, so you do also other type pipes, and he said, no, just for cables. We have two customers in Germany. So I mean, if what he was telling me was really what they are actually doing, I don't think there should be any autonomy for any of his workers. You know, they produce a particular one product for two customers. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, you know.
Is it one establishment there?
I didn't ask that. Okay, but I mean, you know, obviously
sure.
they have different, it's not just the assembly line workers. So there is scope for autonomy. But you know what I mean? It's like, if you are that, the degree of autonomy, of worker autonomy that you need is very different than what Bloom and Marine describe when they say, okay, you know, decentralized and market establishment, you know, I try the IT solution in my Memphis campus and then buy the other one in Seattle, and then we diversify risk. Yeah. So I mean, you know, to then say that, you know, you know, if there was more autonomy to the worker, the plastic pipe firm would have more than two customers in Germany, is a bit an overstress because the business model is that.
Of course. There's no way to know. It's like,
no.
All we do here is like a very broad stroke. And so the lack of trust is basically a corollary of this picture. The lack of trust arguments come from this picture. Because again, Greece is such an outlier here. By the way, we use PIAC just because PIAC is like four times the size of WMS. WMS shows the exact same thing. So I buy this picture and basically try to see what it informs us about.
So, okay, so in Greek society and politics, one of the main characteristics is lack of trust. Which is defined lack of trust between people and the government, government towards the people, people towards the companies, and vice versa. So if we assume that this is the case, this perfectly reflects this kind of picture. But when you say lack of trust, is between whom? Coming from where and in where?
So the lack of trust is, again, one way in which I interpret this picture. And living in Greece and having talked to Greek entrepreneurs, like, there's nothing in my data that says, oh, this is lack of trust. I'm just tying it to something that is well known, as exactly you said, that could explain this. And so there was a Stathis Kalivas presented work on trust here. Surprised you guys didn't bring it. And I watched it because I found it like last week. And he makes really good points. Like, actually, Greece is not so bad in the lack of trust.
Yes.
But his points were about cases where, you know, it's two random people. That his point would not apply to you and your boss.
Sorry, would not apply to
you? Would not apply to you and your boss. Like, the boss and employee is an antagonistic relationship. The random guy coming to ask me in Thessaloniki, in Paralia, well, yeah, the phone, it's fine. I would give it. Like, this is like, I definitely understand his point. Like, we have like Philotim and all that. But it doesn't really apply to professional relationships, I think. So, sorry, Kevin, you want to say
no.
Did that answer your question?
I was wondering, lack of trust. From whom towards whom? Is it that the employee doesn't trust the employer? Or is it the other way around?
Okay, sorry. So
it's all right.
This is employer to employee.
Okay.
Like, I'm not going to let my employee be on the register for too long because they might steal.
The other way around, does this also apply?
I mean, it might affect in general, like wealth, human capital accumulation, how loyal you are to the firm, turnover. Which, you know, indirectly may also, I guess, affect size. But I mean, the main channel we're thinking is that.
Understood, thank you.
One way to look at this is to look at more recent data about the share of firms that allow people to work from home, because this would be a reflection of the trust from the employer towards the employee.
No, it's a really good point. Are you aware?
Not sure. But take a look at that.
Yeah.
You could theoretically plot the same graph with survey data about trusting your employer or trusting your employees, or, for example, the survey of access to finance would have this type of trust questions. I don't know if it's exactly the same.
This
here.
The one?
Yeah. Well, it would have some.
Used it quite a bit. Okay. Maybe.
But at least if they have a similar trend, you could basically push the story of trust.
Okay. No. That's a good idea.
Well, you don't need the story of trust.
No, no, I really don't. I think it nicely dovetails, because we know this Greece scores super low on this, and Greece scores super low here. I think trust is, you know, pretty clear possibility about what is happening. Yeah, you're right. I may have pushed this a bit too much. I really want.
In this audience, actually.
it really was not my intention. I think it's a likely scenario about what is happening. Okay. So, yeah, it's the same thing. So, clear relationship between management practice and labor productivity coming from much better papers than ours. I'm really not going to push it, again, because the sample size is getting really small for this. Because we got access to restricted WMS data, but that covers about like half of the firm's degrees of WMS. So it's getting embarrassingly low. We just plot, it seems to work, but this was not the point. We just basically, for completeness, we also plot, okay, we see this positive relationship, which we would expect to see. And last point here is that this may be, this bad management will be more of a problem with, we think, in ICT intensive sectors because of this well-known complex relation between management and whether you can exploit ICT. Like this famous Bresnahan Benyolsa quip, you don't just turn on your computer and get productivity growth. Like there's a complex interplay between ICT capital and management organizational practices. And indeed, we find that ICT intensive sectors tend to have better management practices. This is, of course, not causal. It could be just, you know, better managements are attracted to cool ICT intensive industries. But to the extent that there is, like, you need better managers to exploit ICT, it's not great. Okay, so how much time do we have?
So we're kind going with all of us for discussion, but we have another 35 minutes to the end.
Okay.
Of the center, so yeah, we'll let you go a bit faster.
Okay. Okay. Just drink a little bit. Okay, so the third part of the paper looks at innovation technology adoption. I'm sure you guys have seen the 1,000 charts where Greece scores really badly in anything to do with digital skills, adoption, infrastructure. So these come from DESI. Digital Economy Society Index Reviewers, that's a well-known survey of this. So Greece scores very low on digital skills, like last in ICT specialists as a share of the labor force, last in digital intensity of SMEs, last in most digital infrastructure metrics except for 5G, which has improved quite a bit, and e-commerce after COVID, and it's pretty much the same spirit in all surveys. So there's also, so DESI is run every year or two, so you can see different vintages, and there's been basically no improvement in relative terms. There has been in absolute terms, except for the government. The government has gotten much better. Of course, this is bad because innovation, technology, adoption are key drive, the key drivers for a long time. So one of Kortos, Yannis Kalogiro, that's his lab, Laboratory of Industrial and Energy Economics, I got this now, at NDUA. It's a very, really novel and unique survey on innovation, technology adoption, and participation in GVCs and some other stuff, but this is one we focus on. It's a representative sample of a bit over 1,000 manufacturing firms. So for Greece, it's quite big. Like it's a decent chunk of the total sector. The distribution size is what you would expect. We have about 2/3 of the firms belonging to family-owned. And we focus on exactly this, the role of size, family ownership, and in GVC participation, and examine how these affect innovation and digital adoption. And why do we do this? Well, to start this, as we said many times before, it's well-known Greece is very heavy on small firms, most of whom are family-owned. And there's a very, the literature is pretty clear on the fact that firm size is associated with a bunch of good stuff, about technology adoption and innovation, less clear about family-owned firms. Like this, some part of the literature thinks they're better for innovation, some are worse, like family firms are a bit more nimble, less principal ledger problems, so we're agnostic on this.
Now about GVC participation, we want to focus on this because it's such a big part of Dutch manufacturing now, and Greek firms are largely absent from global value chain. The causality here is unclear because on the one hand, you need to have a minimum of technological sophistication to be able to integrate in the global value chain. But at the same time, being in the value chain exposes you to knowledge spillovers from other firms on the chain, and you know, you get better technology now. So we show here how a bunch of different innovative activities vary by firm size. So the question is whether you have, firm is asked whether they have implemented these types of innovations over the past 2 years. So this is 2019, so 17 to 19. Things may have changed since. So we have like innovation in products or services, processes, marketing, innovation, and whether you have your own R&D department. And basically you see like pretty much for every different type of innovation, there's a very clear element of size going on. And this is starker whether you have your own R&D department. Over half of large firms do, less than 20% of micro firms. So, I mean, this is not surprising, but it's really, really stark. The other thing to note here, which surprised us, is that apparently Greece is not bad across the EU in terms of innovation collaboration. And similar survey by Eurostat actually singled out the fact that Greek firms collaborate quite a bit in innovation. It's like a saving grace. Okay, so here we have five different types of digital technologies and see how basically their adoption rates. We have big data, e-commerce, advanced communication, which is like things like digital procurement or e-invoicing, new generation networks, which is cloud, and advanced software like CRM, ERP, and the like. And it's not great. Most of these technologies are just not taken up at all by about half the firms. So in fact, over 50% of firms respond either do not use at all or use very little to all of the questions. Again, not surprising, but not super encouraging. Now, being a family firm seems to be a really big driver in this. Here we have average marginal effects from order logic regressions of technology adoption on family firms, controlling for firm size, that's crucial. It's quite stark, like just to give you the raw numbers, so for big data, we have 61% of family firms do not use it at all versus 47 of non-family firms. So it's not like non-family firms are doing great, but this is, clearly a big driver. The only difference is advanced software, but this is not really advanced software. It's like CRM and ERP, not that advanced anymore. Like it's like SAP, firm SAP. Okay, now GVCs do seem to also drive a little bit of the results. Like few firms are GVCs, but the ones that do have enhanced innovation performance. Two-thirds of firms in GVCs report product innovations versus less than 50 overall. 50% process innovation versus less than 30% overall. And this is robust across firm sizes. And this actually an even bigger differential for large firms. Is there a question? Oh, sorry. And also GVC participation is positively associated with the adoption of digital technologies across all questions.
Okay. It's not causal.
No. But it's a... I mean, it's good in a sense. We didn't really have any other evidence that we found on GVCs or Greece, so we thought it was important to mention it. Okay, so final kind of thing we'd like to touch upon is expert performance, mostly because such a big driver of the progress for Greece is exactly to foster improved expert sector, because overall trade balance improved a lot initially under the programs, but almost exclusively on the import side. Because imports plummeted and exports grew really, really slowly. Things have improved on the export side, definitely grown as a fraction of GDP, but the trade balance has deteriorated again quite a bit. There's still a big concern about the dependence on imported inputs. This is definitely the case for oil, which is still about a third of our goods exports. By definition, 100% of the intermediate is imported. But it's even the case for tourism, like, because this big reliance on imports for accommodation and food. Okay, so first thing we saw here is a measure of the extensive margin of trade. This picture shows the log of the total four-digit product destination country export pairs for Greece and Portugal, which is the best comparison country for Greece. And we saw logs because this allows for easier interpretation of the magnitudes. So these are, like, 2005, it's about 4,000 for Greece, about 5,000 for Portugal. And you see that pre-crisis, the two countries were developing pretty similarly, but after the after 2010, Greece really slowed down. And so this is an extensive margin. This is that we're looking at export penetration. You get a different entry if you export olive oil to Russia versus Japan. So the fact we slowed down quite a bit shows like a lower growth in export penetration relative to Portugal. And you know, this aligns well with other things we know about that period. Credit constraints were so big that you know, you couldn't get trade credit, so basically you couldn't find new markets. But of course, it's not only how much you export, it's also what you export. And this is what we want to look at. And here we use the Balassa index, pretty well known to people in trade, to measure relative comparative advantage. And you have, like, the country said to have relative comparative advantage in a product if the ratio of exports of this good to total exports is higher than the world overall. So it's a normalized export share. And we use a three-digit product classification because we want to map it to ICP intensity. And Greece had has RCA in 2019 had RCA for 69 out of 252 products. But the problem is that if we break down by technological sophistication, we see that Greece has RCA for only one out of 17 high-tech products. And I think it's batteries, but I'm not too sure. And 14 out of 71 in the medium term. Instead, most Greek goods with RCA greater than one are in resource-based manufacturers, like think of things like aluminum products, and then primary products. Two-thirds of goods for which Greece has relative comparative advantage come in this group. So having been able to export Greece with high technological content is good because you know it's they're more expensive, so you get higher export share. But they may also matter because to the extent that we think that what you export has implications for growth, this goes back to this very, very famous paper by Hasman and Rochek, like what you export matters. And the idea is basically that not all goods have the same growth implications on the one hand, and on the other hand, that specialization patterns are to some extent random and not fully determined by fundamentals. So if you manage to latch onto a good, some goods that allow you to grow more, they may allow you to grow more conditional on fundamentals. So basically, countries with high export sophistication relative to current development levels will grow more relative to similar countries with less sophisticated export. And they produce an index ranking of goods by sophistication levels, and they show that it's a robust predictor of future growth, and we try to emulate it for Greece now. So we have two measures that we use here. So first is PRODI, it's at the good level. So it's a weighted average of GDP per capita across countries where the weights are the relative shares of country exports relative to aggregates. It's a mouthful, but basically this should be high for goods that rich countries export relatively more. This should be high for semiconductors and low for bananas. Then you take the PRODI and average it across countries, weighted by the shares of the good in each country's export. So PRODI is high, so XP is high for countries whose export basket is sophisticated because they export goods rich countries export. Obviously, it's going to be high for rich countries, but it should also be high for countries that export rich country stuff. So think of it as an expected value of a country's GDP given its export. Okay, so we take XP and do the following. We regress it we regress log pro the log of x before 08, and plot the residual here. So the further to the right you are in this chart, it means that the higher was your GDP per capita relative to what should have been given the sophistication of your export. So obviously, Norway is a massive outlier because Norway is really rich because of oil and gas. Oil and gas are not, you know, don't require much sophistication, but you know, they continue rich.
Next. So XP and GDP, because you said they're not collinear, XP and GDP growth. Because you said
XP could
be a measure of GDP, country's GDP.
Think of it as like the expected value of your GDP that's explained by your export.
Okay.
So basically,
if you
do the regression, you take the residual, the higher it is, it means that your GDP is too high given the sophistication of your country. The Bahamas is high here, the Cayman is high here, for different reasons. But that's basically the point. And then we plot actual growth from 08 to 18 on this deviation. What I basically want to show here is that Greece sticks out. So this is 08 to 18. This is, you know, the largest depression on a vast economy has in 80 years. Even if it weren't for this, we should not have expected Greece to grow too much given the sophistication of its exports. Should have been here. Is it like a really, really simple exercise? No causality, nothing going on here. I just find it very, very stark. We should have known. Okay, the bad news is that...
Sorry, this is exports of goods, yeah? So, you know, Norway has the oil, Greece has the tourism, and whatever it is.
Exactly.
So, it partly says that during that period, Greece didn't manage to move from tourism to actual goods. But then it didn't also because of the capital controls of the, you know, the risk in
capital controls was 70%.
The whole period under the programs, we couldn't really, you know, an exporter couldn't actually borrow to export.
Sure, but we couldn't. But the point is that even if it weren't for all that, this figure said that you probably would not have grown as much. But that's the point. And unfortunately, things have not changed much. This is XP 2018 to XP 08, pretty much exactly where we were. It's a typo, it should be GR. Unfortunately, there's a massive lag in production of this data. 2019 and 2020 is available for Greece. 2020 is junk, obviously, for exports. Doesn't matter. The 2019 is not available for other countries. Like, to the extent that there has been some improvement, and it's clear, like, exports of manufacturing have improved. IP for manufacturing has improved. It's not going to show here for like 2-3 years. So, I'm pretty sure things have improved. Not sure by how much, but we can really get our hands on it. Okay. Now, any questions? Okay. So we also have a couple of policy proposals split into the three buckets that we'll look at. First, education, skills, and labor market policies should ensure upskilling and firms can allow to flexibly use workers according to labor market needs. So some of which, since we started writing this, some of these have been implemented, which is good. Not thanks to us, just some of which are so obvious. One is a broadening industry university cooperation, and this creates a double dividend because not only students manage to get market relevant skills soon, you also have a reduction in labor shortages for firms. Then we need a balance between formal education, infratraining, and lifelong learning. Going back, we were discussing before, like, you know, NTUA produces fantastic students that, you know, great at math, but in terms of thinking outside the box, not so much. And so I'm sure we all have come in contact with this. Like, there's definitely need to be a change there. And then another important one, which is also changing slightly, is improving the connection between universities and market, like career days, and implement job finding skills, including like coaching, how to write your CV, how to open in an interview. Second, on management practices, the really big concern here is that whatever you do is going to have to be related to, it has to do with what's going on inside of the firm. So it's very, very difficult to change. Like there's no direct policy lever. There's nothing you can mandate other than basically exposing managers to better ways of doing that. Like incentivizes in-house training, managerial skills of employees. And one, you know, internationally successful paradigm is the German Mittelstand. Like this backbone of German manufacturing, which is mostly middle-sized firms, family-owned for centuries, but professionally managed. And on the finally, on the technology adoption and innovation, definitely we have to improve on engaging the capacity of research capacity of universities, like valorizing research to create marketable products. Encouraging technology transfer initiatives, and this is really something that has improved a lot since we started writing this. Things like Demokritos, Science Agora, Himidis, this new venture on AI, Konstantinos Daskalakis, definitely been big improvements in that regard. And finally, promoting regional innovation initiatives that we were discussing before. Jan is a very successful prototype of this. You have a really big successful tech scene coming in a small, medium-sized city in Greece, coming almost exclusively from a good local university. And also, yeah, take advantage of you know, whatever changes come, the global value change, so we can enter them through nearshoring.
No. Very good. So I will open to the floor for wider discussion. We only have 15 minutes, but we asked quite a few of the questions. But before I pass the floor to Kevin, I want to ask just about, so as you said, some of these policy recommendations were kind of happened. We can even say were picked up. Why not? They do happen, you know, in the top tier of the economy or the market, you know, the big firms, the good firms, the rest of the firms. So I wonder whether, the problems that you identified, I think, you know, probably would all agree spot on and really characterizing the economy across. But whether the policy, so my question is whether the policy recommendations are things that will create more polarization, more duality in the Greek economy. These are things that can happen, you know, if you have industry-university cooperation schemes that will benefit the top tier, and they will create more of inequality and structural duality within the economy. So they will then accentuate the problem of the small lagging part of industry. Likewise, if you do, you know, kind of, I don't know about managerial skills, but definitely if you do technology transfer and stuff, there's a part of the economy that would be just unaffected by that. So would you worry at all a bit about this kind of possibility of polarization, kind of structural duality?
I mean, yes and no. So one of the problems with Greek industry is we don't have enough big firms. And our big firms are not big enough for international standards. Like the largest firm in the Athens Stock Exchange, like five billion market cap. Mytilineos is about that. That's it. We need more of them. And if we can help them alleviate the shortage concerns that are real and well known by any means, this should be negative good for the country. And so this literature on dispersion productivity and how, you know, you have too little flow of resources from low to high productivity firms. Improving upon this will definitely help the good small firms that have a hard time growing because of those concerns. And you know, we haven't talked too much about industrial policy, but if we want to talk about it, one, like you start by, you know, allowing failure. This is the hallmark of the developers. Like, you need to have failures. If you don't, then you just create rights. So if we put those policies in place, you do get more polarization. This is the nature of the market. So if you have polarization because the leaders are moving ahead, it's fine. You just need the others to catch up.
All new entrants.
All new entrants.
Super.
On the, it's very interesting research, thank you. On the third aspect, innovation capacity of universities in Greece to be the stimulus. It strikes me that each of these three points are wishes that could have been enumerated 20 years ago or beyond. For the third one, what would make us optimistic that the stimulus of innovation capacity of universities is sufficiently strong to achieve the effects that you're hoping for? In other words, innovation capacity of Greek universities on a comparative basis doesn't strike me as being tremendously great. So why would we be optimistic about the effects?
That's not true. So we're actually really good in the Horizon programs, for one. So higher share than expected given
true.
GDP and
true.
I actually don't really know the breakdown of this, but my perceptions overall, Greek academics are pretty good in getting grants of open competitions for specific things. Not as good in basic research. You get money to do whatever you like. As well, the Pesadidis report actually went hard on this. But my sense that overall, for a big bunch of Greek academia, there's no interest in commercially developing whatever they're working on. I'm an economist, so what do? I know that what I'm working on cannot be commercialized. But things like engineers, physicists, whatever, what they're working on can be useful. For me, the biggest surprise in that field that I learned about the past few years is Beta Kaia. I don't know if anyone has heard of it here. I think you're from Thessaloniki, you should know
yeah,
Beta Kaia.
Yeah,
so it was a spin-off from University of Thessaloniki 30 years ago that they could not get funding from the university. They left it, they opened up a firm, it was sold last year for 1.25 billion. I had never heard of it. No one has, you know. So you do have some pockets of excellence. You just help them flourish.
Well, that's an example where they escaped the university.
Absolutely,
it's fine.
But
so the policy advice is close to the university.
But the brain power was there. The brain power was there. Just the system was not conducive to letting them function as well as it could have.
Doesn't ITE have a technology transfer office?
Yeah.
Would this perform better than the average sort of?
I mean, ITE is also another example. So Fortnet, okay. Now it's gone, but it was a really pretty successful technology transfer program, like valorizing research and doing to a successful company for a while.
Sure.
I'm saying the pockets of excellence are there. It's just they're not as big and not as ever present as we would like. So I think Pissarides' report was really good at identifying these issues, and also some statistics, like how long it takes to get to get the patents. I'll just give you an example. My experience based on this grant, we got this grant from the director for this project. We took way longer than we should have to get the funding cleared from Medicare. And, you know, they also kept a lot of money from it. Okay, it's not a big grant. So, you know, we didn't really have any cost for this. And, you know, if we were actually trying to patent something, it would have been an issue.
Okay. let me know if there's questions, but can I ask something? So in the more regional, I guess, regional economics of affiliates, so there's a lot about the kind of triple helix and, you know, and parts of management, connection between businesses, university sector, and either government or the local actors. And a lot about, you know, how you can get this knowledge transfer from businesses into from university research into commercialization, valorization of to businesses, is about the quality of institutions, both informal like trust, but really about sort of governance and, you know, sort of whether contracts are, are secure and how long it would take you to, if you want to challenge a contract, you know, to resolve your dispute and things like that, so judiciary and so forth. So in a way, then you would go and say, okay, you know, before we do all this, what we need to do is to fix our institutions. But then you may have to wait a few decades before you do. So is there something that, you know, from the work you did or other discussions, you know, within the team or outside, you would say that something that can overcome problems of institutional quality? Yes.
Like a low-hanging fruit that could do too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because it's fine to say, okay, you know, engage innovation capacity for universities and encourage technology transfers, but if why these things don't happen, it's not because of the potentials of the universities or the businesses, but it's because of the low trust, low institutional quality, big admin burden environment, then, you know, is there some ways of overcoming this that are not dependent on fixing your institutions first?
You don't have to think more about that.
Yeah.
I don't know. The example you said about contracts, the most gracious description of the Greek economy and of the adjustment programs, the fact that the legal system has not changed in the least, always comes up. No matter what metric you use, by far the worst of it. I'm not saying that I don't know, I know why, but this has not been fixed. And this is definitely a big issue.
And also, I wonder, in a way, kind of follows up with the point that Vasilis was making. So, for example, if you show this bar chart that Greek family-run business do not use big data, I mean, I think it would be, and it kind of, yeah, if we were to interpret this as a problem, which I don't think it is, I think it's kind of quite normal, we would not, you know, do U.S. family-owned banks use, family-owned firms use big data? Probably not. So I wonder whether there is a little bit of in a more sort of philosophical sense, there is a bit of managerial paternalism. This is what we should be doing. This is what good management system should look like, and ignoring the configuration of the Greek industry, the Greek economy, the trust issues perhaps, and the institutional configuration more broadly. And I think this is something that I admire Nick Bloom's work and John Marine's work, but taking some of the policy recommendations and plugging them into Greece, I think is completely unrealistic and it's not going to achieve. So I wonder whether some of these policy proposals should be seen in a sort of more critical way. For example, education. Maybe we're over-educating. Well, we are over-educating in Greece, right? And there are welfare losses associated with that. So maybe the word on the street should be, let's cut down on university education and focus more on apprenticeships or more technical stuff. Mm-hmm. So, and I would like somebody to be bold enough to say to the average Greek, you know, your kids should not go to university. You know, it's not good for them and it's not good for the economy, etc. But that might be a very unpopular policy message that nobody's bold enough to say.
I'm okay with that. So it is one of our recommendations, like two, improve on apprenticeships. You just didn't really have space there.
Sure.
Perhaps I should have.
Read the paper.
Yeah.
Oh, the
book.
The book,
exactly. With a very cool cover. this is absolutely the case. And I mean, I talk quite a bit about how, you know, we may have high educational attainment in terms of fraction of people holding degrees, but very bad on skills. Because exactly, there's no alignment between the needs of the market and what comes out of
universe. And I don't really know how or why, but you know, there's definitely a perception of why this is happening. Now, so on the management, I get what you said, but again, this is manufacturing. So this is already the most productive part of the Greek economy,
yeah.
The one where technology should be used more. And you know, the practice of it, this is not a cafe. Mm-hmm. Cafe, fully agree. My wife runs a family-run cafe, so whatever. But from the manufacturing, we should have a higher, lower amount for how this works.
If there's no more questions or comments, we can bring it to a conclusion.